commies are coming. The commies are coming. It is an old refrain in American politics. Started when Donald Trump was about 10. Well, it's back. You can thank New York City. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte here. At least we hope we will be here, fresh out of his meeting with President Trump. The Iran deal, U.S. relations with NATO, the war in Ukraine. If we can, we're going to cover it all. The president buries a bipartisan housing bill he was about to sign into law, an affordability blunder? Many Republicans think so. What comes next? Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. Let's talk about New York and last night's primary results. Here is a number to consider. 125,381. I know that sounds like a totally random number, but it's not. That's the current number of votes that the three winners of closely watched House Democratic primaries won combined. That's right. The three winners, you can see them here in this graphic, combined again. This is with about 90% of the vote counted to win just over 125,000 votes. For context, there are 5.3 million registered voters in New York City. There are 12.5 million registered voters in New York State. You can do the math yourself. 125,000 votes is a tiny, tiny fraction of the city and state's registered voters. But this is the important part. Wins are wins. And last night's winners were not backed by Democratic leaders in Congress. Chuck Schumer and Akeem Jeffries, well, they have some explaining to do because the winners were endorsed by New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, a new Gotham political kingmaker suddenly overshadowing Schumer and Jeffries. Two of last night's winners, like Mamdani, are Democratic socialists. One, Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, defeated the incumbent Congressman Adriano Espiat, who led the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and had deep roots in his northern Manhattan and Bronx district. Another winner, Claire Valdez, defeated Brooklyn Borough President Antonio Reynosa, endorsed by Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, who in 1992 became the first Puerto Rican woman ever elected to Congress. These wins mean something. Liberal House districts in liberal New York City became more liberal and, importantly, less establishment. Republicans are gathering all these facts and will certainly pay close attention to these new Democratic socialists now heading to Congress. They're also keeping track of where others are winning. Mamdani, of course, is the nation's best-known Democratic socialist. Others include Katie Wilson, the new mayor of Seattle, Janice Lewis George, the incoming mayor of Washington, D.C. Also, the runner-up in Los Angeles mayor's race, Nithya Raman, a Democratic socialist. One other data point to consider, Gallup recently found socialism has a 66% favorability rating among Democrats, while capitalism has a 42% favorability rating. In 2010, by comparison, capitalism led socialism 51% to 50%. Republicans have been gathering all of these trend lines and this morning really began sharpening their rhetoric.
You've been hearing me say for weeks there are many Mamdanis popping up all around the country. It is a dangerous thing. This is not a joke. We are in a fight right now to save the Republic. And every American needs to take this seriously. You need to wake up. This upcoming midterm election is not the midterm elections of years ago. This is going to decide the direction of the country.
You could call it the Bolshevik Revolution of 2026, but the Mamdani takeover of the Democrat Party is official now. We've been talking about it for months, this move to the Marxist socialist left by the Democrat Party. They've become an unrecognizable party. You cannot recognize who the Democrats are anymore. This is surely not your father or grandfather's Democrat Party. They've fully embraced socialism.
And we're going to have a response to that rhetoric a bit later in the show from Kate Connolly, a Democrat who is not a Democratic socialist, but who won the 17th congressional district primary and will face Republican incumbent Mike Lawler in a race that could determine, among many other competitive swing races, who controls Congress in the midterms. Speaking of Congress, President Trump met privately with Senate Republicans after a stunning decision this morning to cancel the signing ceremony for a bipartisan housing bill. We picked things up there with Torian Small, who helped us diagnose the soap opera between Trump and the Senate Republicans that, if you're in a particularly flippant mood, and I just very well might be called the old and the restless. Torian, take it away.
Major, quite the chaotic day, and at the center of it all is President Trump. He was here on the Hill initially to sign that bipartisan landmark housing bill that would have, among other things, put a cap on private equity's ability to purchase single-family homes, a pretty big win across the aisle. And we saw some strange bedfellows really coming forth to support this. The president decided that's not good enough, put that to the side. I want to push my national voter ID law, the Save America Act. He took that to this closed-door GOP Senate lunch, and that's where the fireworks happened. There was one particular moment that we all have been talking about since that meeting ended with Senator Bill Cassidy. He was a senator that President Trump successfully primaried, and they had to go at it. He asked many of those Republicans in the room why they would support the Iran War Powers Resolution that passed this week. He stood up and said, if you really want to know, it's because not too many Americans understand what's your plan, what's the goal with this. And that led to a pretty heated debate with the president. In fact, it was a screaming match, according to the senator himself. He said that the president at one point rubbed salt in the wound by bringing up the fact that he lost his reelection bid. And then ultimately, he said that it came down to a situation where he felt he was being bullied by the president. Take a listen to Senator Cassidy. We caught up with him earlier today.
The president didn't want to hear my question, interrupted me. I didn't care to be interrupted. I felt like I was trying to get answers for the American people. And I'm not going to be bullied when I'm trying to get answers for the American people. And so so it escalated from there. At some point, it de-escalated.
This is notable because this signing ceremony is just another example, recent example, of President Trump flexing his power and influence over Congress in a pretty humiliating fashion. Just a week ago, he canceled the confirmation hearing of Jay Clayton, his pick to lead the intel community, something that Senate Republicans were looking to push through quickly, along with the help of Democrats, because they were unsatisfied with his acting DNI. But ultimately, the president said, no, I want to ensure that the Save America Act is top of mind for all of these lawmakers, and he's willing to, hamper some of their operator modem in order for that to happen.
All right, Small on Capitol Hill. And before I go to Nicole Killian, I just want to read something from the Associated Press that was posted this morning that might have something to do with the president became suddenly obsessed. He's been really obsessed, but suddenly obsessed with the Save America Act, so-called a voter ID law. Let me read. Federal judge on Wednesday permanently barred President Donald Trump's administration from implementing most of his first executive order on elections, part of which sought to require people to show documentary proof of citizenship when they register to vote, meaning his executive order has been nullified permanently. Nicole Killian joins me now from the White House on that and other matters. Nicole.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, the president just wrapped up a press avail with the head of NATO, Mark Rutte. But he did take a number of questions, as did Rutte. But of course, president responding to a range of questions from foreign policy to that very topic that you mentioned, the Save Act or Save America Act, which he continued to champion, saying that this is about voter ID, proof of citizenship, again, repeating false claims that the election was rigged. But that is his rationale for pushing this in Congress, even though Majority Leader John Thune has made clear time and again that the votes simply aren't there. That being said, that was really not the focus of this press avail with Rutte. It was really just about reaffirming ties between the United States and NATO. We know that the president at times has been critical of the NATO alliance, especially some member countries. He's accused them of not paying their fair share. So that did come up in this avail with Rutte, the president saying that he's very disappointed in a number number of European countries, but Ruta coming to their defense, saying that, yes, it's a mixed bag, but this alliance is still strong. Ruta also defending, you know, the president's approach with respect to the war with Iran and this newly inked deal or memorandum of understanding, saying that many European countries are championing what the president is doing because at the end of the day, this is about degrading Iran's nuclear capability. He actually did, I wouldn't call it a PowerPoint presentation, but he did put up a number of signs explaining just the impact that this is having with respect to a number of European countries in terms of their economy and why this was an important step for the president to take. Additionally, the two leaders certainly talked about an upcoming summit in Turkey. The president also taking questions about that very contentious meeting that the president had on Capitol Hill that you just discussed with Torian, but the president also referencing that it was quite a tense meeting and criticizing some of those Republicans, particularly those who supported that Iran War Powers resolution yesterday, barring further military action in Iran without congressional approval, Major.
Yes, the president takes a very dim attitude to Republicans in any way voting to restrain his war-making powers. Nicole Killian, thank you very much. She mentioned the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. He is doing a lot of other things on the White House grounds. We hope that by the end of the show, he will come to the North Lawn and we can have a conversation with him. In the meantime, I'm going to turn to last night's primaries, where the show began. Victories by candidates endorsed by, as I mentioned, New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani. CBS News political director Finn Gomez, right here to my left at the family table. Finn?
Major.
What made an impression upon you, good sir?
Well, what made an impression, like, this was a huge night, no question, for Mayor Mamdani and his you know, this progressive movement that he really started with his outsider win last year, right? He is now the de facto leader of the DSA wing of the party, you know, with these wins last night.
The Democratic Socialist of America.
Yes, Democratic Socialist of America. Couple things to remember. One, these are very safe blue districts, right? It doesn't change the chess map for the balance of power come November. You know, probably the most—
As I said— Liberal districts in a liberal city became more liberal.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And and now when you pivot now to the general election, it's like it's a different electorate. You're not playing to your base. And it's and in races outside of places like New York, like in these battleground frontline districts, will these how much will this message sell? Mm-hmm. And how much will it be a deterrent to those who are up for grabs?
All right. There's that. And then there's something that you and I know.
Yes.
Finn Gomez, because in an earlier era of our life covering American politics, we covered the Tea Party.
Yes.
Which was a grassroots, more aggressively conservative part of the Republican Party. And it didn't win everything initially, but it had clearly created influential aspects of the conversation. And that sort of came to full fruition with Trump in 2025 and 2016. Yes. So early victories, grassroots activism and energy can sometimes become something else.
Oh, absolutely.
Is this the Tea Party on the left from your vantage point?
Yeah, absolutely. It is the progressive Tea Party. You and I have been talking about this really since like around the Mamdani win, of course. But yes, look, this is something, and we're seeing it not just in New York, but we have seen it in Maine. We have seen it in places like California, like you talked about.
Seattle.
Where it could potentially grow into something else, right? At the very least, it's likely to tilt the 2028 platform more to the left, like we saw Bernie Sanders in previous cycles. I think that's important. But there are some cautionary tales here.
Sure.
You and I both know about the 2010 cycle, my first midterm cycle that I covered. And in covering the Tea Party movement, what you also saw is like they had a huge wins in the House, like about 63 wins, huge. On the Senate side, they lost some pretty close races.
They lost winnable races because they nominated people who could not win a general election.
Exactly. And I think that's the cautionary tale here, that this could potentially be the same thing once he pivots to the general election.
But in politics, energy matters. And energy, at least in New York, was evident last night. Finn Gomez, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to bring in CBS News Executive Director of Elections and Surveys. He's your friend. He's my friend. His name is Anthony Salvanto. Anthony, tell us what happened in New York last night.
Major, everything you're talking about there is that in the modern media age, things that happen locally quickly become national. And I'm going to show you a map and I'm going to tell you a story because it's going to relate back to those points about socialism that you mentioned earlier. Let me show you this. This is the New York 13th. Now, this is going to be a slam dunk win for the Democrats. It's not a competitive district come November. But where Chevalier wins here and knocks off incumbent SBI, if I go through this and I look at the areas in the district, I see places here in yellow where she did better are a little bit younger, yeah, a little bit more affluent once you control for the Latino population in these precincts up here. What I mean by generational change is you saw a lot of incumbents lose, and oftentimes you see younger voters who are looking to push out some of that old party leadership that you described at the top. So that's number one. But the other one comes back to what you said at the top about socialism, too. If you look at the polling, you will see not just among Democrats, but often among younger people with a more positive view of socialism more broadly. And I just want to unpack really quickly, that doesn't always mean all the same thing to all of them. For some of them, it's about government control over parts of the economy. For others, it's just about redistribution or taxes. There's a whole lot of issues in there, all of which is to say, a party that's out of power is going to fight over their policy and fight over their direction. And that's the larger context going on here.
And Anthony, before I let you go, this idea of young voters being involved in these races, first of all, as registered voters, participating voters in primaries, and a significant fulcrum in the outcome, that's important because once young voters get in, they tend to stay. And if they become a recognizable part of a party's power swing, it really matters.
They tend to stay. And if we're talking about fights within the Democratic Party, Democratic Party needs them. It has relied on younger voters. The fact, though, is their view of this economy is obviously proving to be very different structurally than the previous generation's view of it. Part of that has to do with opportunity. So the party is trying to fight for those voters and make a case to them. That is what you are seeing playing out here.
Anthony Salvanto, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you. Still to come on The Takeout, New York Democratic congressional candidate Kate Conley joins the show after her primary victory. What she thinks about all this whole conversation that just played out before you, the numbers, socialism, centrism, all the rest. Plus, a new report finds Polymarket is paying content creators to post videos of them winning, get this, fake bets. One of the reporters who broke this investigative story joins me. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. Democrats look at New York Republican Congressman Mike Lawler's Hudson Valley District 17th as one of the most gettable for them this November. Lawler will face combat veteran and Biden administration national security staffer Kate Conley, who won last night's primary. Here with California Democratic Congressman and chair of the House Democratic Congress, Pete Aguiar, on the importance of that particular race. Listen.
The path to 218 isn't through those districts that the mayor endorsed in. The path to 218 and to Democrats getting rid of the chaos and the insanity that we see is through districts like New York 17, where Kate Conley got through her primary and is going to beat Lawler. I mean, that's what this is about.
And Kate Conley joins me now. Congratulations on your primary victory. You heard Pete Aguilar describe your race and the importance thereof and predicting you're going to beat Mike Lawler. How are you going to do that?
Major, I love that prediction, and I agree. But we certainly have a lot of work ahead of us between now and November to make that true, to make the case to the voters of New York 17 that ultimately they deserve better. You know, their lives since Mike Lawler was elected in November of 2022 have only gotten harder. For people working full-time jobs, they're struggling to put food on the table, you know, keep a roof over their heads, make ends meet. And since he's been elected, all of that has gotten harder, not easier. And that reality is going to catch up with Mike Lawler this fall. And offering people a better option, not a political operative who's out for himself and his next political gig, but a public servant who's already demonstrated that I'm willing to make any sacrifice for this country, for our families, for our community. And change is coming.
I don't know if you heard the first block of the show, Kate, but there was a quote that we ran from Speaker Mike Johnson, who said, Democratic socialists and the Mamdani influence on the Democratic Party is a dangerous thing. It's not a joke. We're fighting to save our republic. Steve Scalise, the majority leader, called it the Bolshevik Revolution of 2026. I know you're not a Democratic socialist. You don't have to answer for those who are, but you know these attacks are going to come at you because Republicans are going to say you are just like those Democratic socialists who won last night in New York City.
Well, let's first call out the hypocrisy of Mike Johnson claiming that anything other than a Republican-controlled Congress is dangerous to the American people right now. What we have seen with this administration, enabled by cowards in Congress like Mike Lawler, is a blank check for the Trump administration, who's only looking out for themselves and their billionaire buddies while working people pay the price, literally and figuratively. We just saw Mike Lawler vote for H.R. 1, the One Big Ugly Bill last year, that gutted Medicaid, that ripped health care away from 37,000 people right here in our district. So when we talk about dangerous, I will tell you, for working people here in the Hudson Valley, a Republican-controlled Congress is what's been dangerous for their daily lives. And when it comes to what people are seeking right now, I think what we saw last night, Major, is that people want a fighter. They want someone that they believe is going to get in there and not accept that problems are too hard to solve. That's going to go and push for solutions, not excuses. And that is what we demonstrated here in New York 17, where voters chose a proud West Point graduate, decorated Army combat veteran of 16 years and six tours. And I'm so humbled to have this honor.
If I were to be a constituent of yours, to be, meaning someone who was thinking about voting for you, and I said, well, how do you differ from Democratic socialists in New York City about the future of ICE? And how do you differ from them about the future of USAID to Israel? What would you tell that person?
As somebody who's dedicated my life to keeping America safe since 9/11, going off to West Point, serving the Army, having the privilege of a lifetime to lead America's sons and daughters, I would say the American government has a responsibility to ensure the safety and security of the American people. That includes border security. That includes having law enforcement that is serving our communities. And what is hurting people most right now is how our government is failing to address the kitchen table issues. The affordability crisis is real. After the last 15 months on the trail, I can tell you that is the number one thing I hear every day. Seniors on fixed incomes talking about having to make trade-offs between groceries and prescriptions. Families working two jobs who are afraid they're going to lose their homes. You know, that is what government is failing to address. And if we don't focus on that, if we don't do better, we're not going to gain people's trust, and thus we're not going to gain their votes.
Real quickly then, you would not support abolishing ICE, I'm gathering from that answer. And let me just ask you directly, would you be in favor of ending all U.S. support for Israel currently?
So when we talk about supporting immigration, we do have a broken immigration system that needs to be fixed. When we're talking about what we saw happen earlier this year in January, where federal agents on American streets assaulted, harassed, and killed American citizens, the very people they are sworn to serve and protect, and have this administration, instead of calling for transparency and investigations, cover it up, that's unhinged and un-American. That's not a Republican or Democratic issue. That's an American issue. And so when we talk about the rule of law here in America, I fought for a country where the rule of law applies to everyone, from the president to federal agents to regular people. And so I do believe that people who commit crimes, including federal agents, need to be held legally accountable. When it comes to the conflict in the Middle East, I will tell you, as someone who has been to war multiple times, the last thing I want to ever see is another generation of anyone's sons or daughters have to go to war. We got to get on a pathway to a two-state solution. We have to find ways to reconstruct and rebuild to ensure ceasefires persist and then get third parties in to be a peacekeeping force. And also talk about Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And we do have a responsibility to ensure that Israel continues to exist as a nation, the Jewish people are protected, that we stop rising anti-Semitism here in America. But we can also say, just like I am a proud American and I criticize Donald Trump, I can support the state of Israel and criticize the administration, how it conducts itself. That's what democracies do.
Kate Conley, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
New investigation by the Wall Street Journal found that a social media army was paid by Polymarket to post videos of them winning fake wagers. One of the reporters who broke that story, it's a really good one, joins me next, right here on The Takeout. Welcome back to Takeout. Thanks for hanging out with us. Here's a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. General Chris Donahue, it's not a name you're probably familiar with, but he serves as commander of U.S. Army Europe and Africa, submitted retirement papers this week, becoming the latest high-level officer to depart the military during the second Trump administration. The Army confirmed he will relinquish his command on July 2nd. Sources tell CBS News Donahue has clashed somewhat frequently with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. He will need a presidential waiver to retire as a four-star general as he served fewer than 3 years at that grade. Donahue is largely known as being the last American soldier on the ground in Afghanistan prior to boarding the last U.S. aircraft that departed Kabul. He was also among the first senior officers on the ground to assist Ukrainian forces after Russia's invasion. In a story first reported by CBS News, a lobbying group of former Trump campaign and administration officials is cashing in on pardon lobbying, that is to say, lobbying for presidential pardons. Federal lobbying disclosures reveal that Mo Strategies, that's the company's name, was paid $500,000 from a law firm in Virginia to assist them on a pardon-related matter. The filing said the firm lobbied both to the White House and Justice Department, and their president, Marty Obst, who worked on multiple Trump campaigns, says more pardon work of that kind, possibly lucrative work, is expected. A new report from the Wall Street Journal alleges that Polymarket paid content creators to post videos about winning bets that did not exist. The journal found the prediction market enlisted what they call a, quote, social media army to post videos of fake winnings that totaled a combined $1.9 million. Polymarket says they are planning to conduct what it calls a comprehensive audit of active promotional content. Wall Street reporter Caitlin Ostroff joins me now. And we should note, Polymarket has a data partnership with Dow Jones, publisher of the Wall Street Journal. The journal used only publicly available data for this analysis. That's an important codicil. So Caitlin, as I understand this story, if you were unwitting and watching these videos, you would think, oh my gosh, A, winning is easy, winnings are real, and these content creators are really cool. Last point, the content creators may be cool, but the bets weren't real and they didn't make money.
No, and these videos are very convincing. I mean, we were reviewing dozens of these for probably about 2 weeks before we realized that these are not real videos of trades being placed. You know, when we first came across these social media accounts, we were trying to figure out, because Polymarket data is public, it's on blockchain, we were trying to figure out if we could trace these trades. And what we started hitting up against was that we couldn't. And so for a while, we were trying to figure out why that was, until one day we stumbled upon one video that referenced a different URL called poymarket.com. And that was when we realized that the videos that we were watching were not trades actually being placed on polymarket.com.
And what did Polymarket tell you? And what do these content creators say about what they disclose or don't disclose?
Yeah, so Polymarket told us that, you know, it's looking at the active promotional content that it has up. The creators told us that Polymarket directed them not to disclose that they were paid by Polymarket, and to make the trades look real and convincing. We were told by creators that if Polymarket, which reviewed videos before they were posted, saw that the videos didn't look authentic enough, that they would send them back to them to be fixed so that they looked more genuine.
And how did the amplification of these fake videos work, Caitlin?
Yeah, so originally creators, often college-age students, would post these videos to TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and those would get some amount of reach from people organically coming across it. From there, Polymarket paid for a third-party company to manage what are called clippers. So these are people who run social media accounts across the world who basically make new sock puppet accounts that take the content that the Polymarket creators made and they recirculate it across the internet. And so that amplification boosted it to millions more viewers, primarily targeting a US audience. We reviewed instructional materials that the third-party clipping campaign gave to those clippers, and it said, you know, the target for this is at least a 60% US audience.
Caitlin Ostroff with the Wall Street Journal. Great reporting, fascinating story. Thank you for your time very much.
Thank you for having us.
Next, what last night's victories from those Mayor Zohran Mamdani-endorsed candidates might or might not say about the future of the Democratic Party. Our political strategist panel will weigh in on that and a whole lot more. This is The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout, political panel time. But first, welcome back to The Takeout Tavern. I've told you it's going to be a regular part of this program. Also, we had plans, really well-organized plans, to have the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte on the show. The meeting with Trump ran late. He's doing other things. He will not be available tonight, maybe sometime in the future. Meanwhile, Democratic strategist Dimitri Cross is here, Republican strategist, former DHS spokesperson under the Trump administration, Trisha McLaughlin. We've got beer. I've got my coffee. It's always coffee, kids. You know that. I don't run with scissors on this show. So, Amisha, I want to get your sense of what happened in New York last night and what it does or doesn't mean for the future of the Democratic Party.
Well, what happened in New York last night was that candidate to Zohran Mamdani actually endorsed. They won, and they won big. And they ran on affordability concerns. They ran on what matters to the people. They were not afraid to step out against traditional way, I think, in terms of the Democratic Party. And they were very much strong candidates who spoke to the needs of the people.
What does it mean for Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, New Yorkers both, who weren't where Mamdani was?
Well, Chuck Schumer was in trouble even before this race happened, to be fair.
No doubt.
But I think that it sends a message to the Democratic Party that it's not just about affordability. It's also ensuring that you're really listening to and taking the pulse of where your voters happen to be. I don't want to, you know, prognosticate this as a huge national shift, because I still think that New York is New York. And we're talking about the Bronx. We're talking about Brooklyn. We're talking about areas of New York that are already highly liberal and highly blue. So I don't think that it can be extrapolated on the whole at all. But I do think that the issues related to people's pocketbooks and housing and affordability, the cost of gas, the cost of food, that is not going to go away anytime too soon.
Patricia, you know well that Republicans are going to say not affordability. They're going to say they want to abolish ICE. They want to defund Israel. They want to may possibly eliminate the Israeli state or not even recognize it. All those issues Republicans are going to try to promote nationally.
Oh, absolutely. This is going to have big implications for 2026 and potentially for 2028.
Meaning it's not going to stay in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx.
I can't say it's New York in a vacuum, because, of course, you look at the Maine Senate race, you look at the Michigan Senate race with El Sayed. As with the issues with these New York candidates, the anti-Zionism, the pro-socialism, anti-capitalism. Even one of the candidates out of New York, she is a self-avowed communist herself. The open border policies, abolishing ICE, even one of the candidates saying that she wants to get rid of prisons altogether, including for murder. So this is going to have national implications. And to your point, Republicans view this as a gift, though I do think it's bad for the Democrat Party and it's bad for the country.
I mean, we just saw polling. There's recent polling to showcase where Americans are writ large as it relates to how they view the war in Iran. I think that it's a very important thing for people to remember that regardless of whether you're on the left or the right, the issue with the Iran war continuing to be ongoing and what it means for people's pocketbooks back home, what it means for individuals who did vote for Donald Trump in large part and supported the Republican Party in many cases was because they talked about being against endless wars. And right now we've walked into
and
one
things
where
being more affordable.
Then things being more affordable. These are things that the president himself ran on that are unfortunately for him right now not true. And every move that he's made since he's been in office, be it whether it was tariff strategy, be it whether it was his actions on health care, they have raised the prices for the average American. And I think that they're going to pay for it at the polls.
And let's talk about something that was on this program. Kate Conley, 17th District of New York, which Pete Aguiar, as we ran that SOT, said that's where the House majority is going to be decided. Yeah. Not in these Mamdani endorsed seats in New York. And she's on here saying, no, I support the state of Israel. We need a two-state solution. And I want border security. So that's where she's going to be, in a swing district that's going to be very competitive.
Yeah, I thought she was actually pretty compelling on the interview. She was measured, and she's where she needs to be, especially after a primary. But I have to say, I think what President Trump, he is doing, what he started doing really yesterday in Pennsylvania, is speaking to the economic woes that Americans are feeling, but also speaking to the economic wins that we have had. He talked about yesterday $10,000 back in the pocketbooks of Pennsylvanians because of extending that tax cuts and and Jobs Act, also $90 billion of investments, those Trump accounts, things that we haven't been able to talk a lot about as a Republican Party because we've been focused on this war. But also, number one, gas prices, lower, 60 cents lower since the last
week. Amisha, you're happy to take this on, aren't you?
The Strait of Hormuz just got closed again. Gas prices are going to go up through the roof yet again. We know that MOU turned out to be as useless as used toilet paper. We also know that the average American, 35 years old and under, still lives at home with their parents. That is not the American dream of any adult. And a lot of that is because people can't afford housing. And just today, the president shot down a bipartisan bill. Bipartisan. It's hard to get bipartisanship in this administration.
On housing
this
and affordability.
On housing affordability.
Amisha, hold that thought. Hold that thought. We got to go to break, and you can have a sip, ladies. You can
Thank
have
you.
A sip. That's what the tavern is here for. Amisha Cross, Tricia McLaughlin, stay with us. More panel when we come back. And then come on. Oh, you can do this on camera. It's okay. Okay. No one's going to judge.
I am a wine.
Proof positive. It's coffee, kids. It's always coffee. Welcome back to The Takeout. Political panel continues. Amisha Cross, Tricia McLaughlin. Amisha, I want to pick up on when we were talking before we went to break. You mentioned the housing legislation. The president had a signing ceremony ready to go at the White House. People were going to come over to it. Reporters were going to cover it. And he canceled it.
Yeah, and I think this shows us a few things. The president's out of touch with where the American reality is. Housing affordability is a top line item for the majority of people across this country, regardless of whether they are in red, blue, or purple districts. And it also showcases that the president, even when giving a bone in bipartisan legislation, he doesn't care about the midterms.
Tim Scott, South Carolina Republican, not a liberal, a conservative. French Hill, North Carolina, not a liberal, conservative. They're both for this. They helped put together the bill. Yes, other Democrats did as well, but they signed off on it. So did Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House. President still canceled.
Absolutely. And for Tim Scott, he actually held several events last week talking about this bill. I went to one of them. He's been talking about housing for a very long time. For the president to cancel it showcases, again, two things. He doesn't care about what the Americans need.
Go ahead,
and he's also somebody
ahead,
who really
Tricia.
Doesn't care about
Go ahead.
Let's remember the facts. This is a little bit of theater. He's going to sign it. He has 10 days.
Or he's not going to veto it and let it come.
He's not going to let it be a pocket veto, which would happen if he didn't sign it within 10 days. He is going to sign it. This is a bipartisan win. This is a piece of legislation that the White House has worked incredibly hard on as well.
And Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, ballyhooed yesterday on social media.
Yes, and this is something that the White House absolutely wants signed, but this is about leverage. Let's keep in mind
the state. He doesn't want more than he wants to upend voting rights.
I don't think that's accurate by any means. I think that the president, as well as many members of the legislature, view that the SAVE Act is going to have generational consequences that the American people need to safeguard our elections. But more than that, you also have to keep in mind the relationship that's happening right now with Senate Republicans and with the president.
It is as testy as it's been in the second term.
Look what just happened yesterday with the Iran resolution.
Right.
Of course.
They lost by two votes.
Well, McConnell and McCormick were not there. So
yeah, where was McCormick? Where was Senator McCormick? He was with the president in Pennsylvania, and the president calls him out today. What were you doing?
Correct.
Well, I was with you, sir.
Let's go with this farce that he's not going to sign this piece of legislation. Of course he is. Of course he cares about this,
but can you apply leverage, Tricia? And this is a serious question. When you don't have the votes and the Republicans in the Senate are not going to abolish the filibuster. Those are the only two outcomes, and they're not going
to
happen.
I think it's bringing everybody to the table, which is what they did today. It sounded like there was a spirited conversation, a spirited meeting today.
The throwdown.
Well, sometimes that's what you need. That's what family needs.
Amisha?
It's just not going to happen. This is a president who does not like taking it on the chin. It's something that he is going to lose on. He knows he doesn't have the votes, but he is going to go down fighting. Right now, with all the redistricting efforts across the country, if you're already redesigning maps to increase your leverage, do you also even need the savings? Back. This is ridiculous. The president knows that his policies are not popular with the American public. He sees his polls in the tank. And at this point, he just wants to jerry-rig the elections to change the outcome.
When you look at polling data, which I mentioned in the open of the show, Gallup shows that among Democrats, socialism has a higher favorability rating than capitalism. Does that disturb you?
I think that most people don't know what socialism actually means. What they do know is that their pocketbooks are in trouble. What they do know is that layoffs
are happening. That's a referendum question for are they happy or not economically.
Exactly. This is more of an economic bill rather than ideological. You ask most people on the street what socialism is, they can possibly name a country they've seen socialism in, but they cannot say the principles of what it actually means. What they do know is that they can't afford food. They can't afford utility bills. They need help with housing. That is what matters to people the most out here. And I think that anything beyond that or trying to narrate this in a philosophical belief system is problematic because Americans have told us.
Trisha, jump in.
That's an indictment of our American education system, of the civic system. If you don't know that socialism has failed every time that it has tried, that is a huge problem for the Democrat Party. It shows where the leadership of the Democrat Party will be. If you are for open borders, if you are against prison for murderers, if you think that capitalism is a failed system, that's going to be—
If you don't see your life progressing in capitalism, you can see it as a failed system. People can't afford to feed their children. People are having less children, not because they don't want them, but because they cannot afford childcare.
Yes, and that was happening under the Biden administration, and that is why—
I'm not saying it's a new fear. I'm saying it's a legitimate fear.
Do you believe socialism is the answer to that?
I don't believe in socialism in general. What I do believe in is taking care of the American people. And what it appears is that individuals are supporting candidates who believe in policies that take care of the American
people. Don't you think it's an indictment on your party, the fact that the
Democrats— No, I think that my party is speaking towards things that are affordable.
If I may finish,
don't you
think it's— Well, that's socialism now. Shouldn't they
have
actual—
Making things affordable is socialism? Making sure families can afford to live is socialism?
If I can finish, that poll just showed that your party said socialism is better than capitalism, 66%. That is an indictment on your party. The only solution is socialism in order for things to be more affordable. That is a problem if your leaders cannot bring solutions.
Trisha, you get the last word. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what happens at the tavern? Things get very, very real. Amisha Cross, Trisha McLaughlin, thanks for having
me. Thank you.
As promised last night, we will end each show from now until July 4th with TV gems produced by this network to celebrate America's bicentennial in 1976. They were a quick reminder called Bicentennial Minutes. CBS aired them in the 8 o'clock hour every night for more than 2 years. Tonight, two Bicentennial Minutes featuring legends, and I mean legends of American film. The first, one of my favorite all-time actors, William Holden. His credits include Sunset Boulevard, Stalag 17, The Bridge Over the River Kwai, The Wild Bunch, and in my opinion, take it for what you care to take it for with, the greatest, most important movie of all time, Network. Your Bicentennial Minute with William Holden.
200 years ago today, Boston civilians were told to surrender every scrap of wool and linen they owned. The British were pulling out of the city, and General William Howe wanted nothing left behind for the American army. Howe gave Crean Brush, a Tory profiteer, authority to collect cloth from the 7,000 civilians staying in Boston. They were warned that anyone trying to hide goods would be dealt with as a rebel. Brush didn't stop at cloth. In 7 days, he had loot worth 20,000 pounds sterling on board the ship Elizabeth bound for Nova Scotia. But Yankee privateers caught the ship at sea and hauled it back to Boston. Crean Brush's loot was spread out for owners to identify and claim. Brush was hustled into the Boston City Jail before angry civilians could claim him. I'm Michael Cole, and that's the way it was.
These historic minutes are sponsored each night by Shell.
Quite obviously not William Holden. There'll be a memo about that, I promise. I hope now our second will be of director Stanley Kramer. I hope. Kramer took enormous risks as a director with films that plunged deep into social debates at the time. And importantly, he pulled no punches. Kramer directed these classics, The Defiant Ones, Inherit the Wind, Judgment at Nuremberg, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. He also produced High Noon and The Caine Mutiny. I very much hope this is your Bicentennial Minute with Stanley Kramer.
I'm Stanley Kramer. 200 years ago today, patriots were preparing to destroy five British men of war at Tappan Zee in the Hudson River. The Americans would use fire ships, boats loaded with wood, straw, and pitch, to be ignited on contact with the men of war. The next night, they met the enemy. Grappling hooks flew in every direction. The Charlotta was caught and the fire ships ignited. The glow could be seen 20 miles away in New York City, warning the British that in this war, American ingenuity and daring would make up for lack of American equipment. I'm Stanley Kramer, and that's the way it was.
Stanley Kramer, I was so happy to see you there. Happy Wednesday, everyone. This is The Takeout. Relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever.